In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Wednesday, September 11th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Today it is Pentagon Solutions, an hour-long look at the challenges the Defense Department is facing both inside and outside the building, and we hear from experts on both inside and outside. Today, highlights of an event hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies looking at DOD's operational energy for the upcoming decade as military branches restructure and draw down both in Afghanistan and Iraq. Marin Lead of CSIS is the moderator of the event. She's their senior advisor for the Harold Brown Chair in Defense Policy Studies and Ground Forces Dialogue. The speakers you'll hear from, Sharon Burke, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff. Starting with a highlight from Secretary Burke, she says DOD and energy are linked in two different ways.
First is in a global sense, and energy as a geopolitical issue and how that's changing and what it means for the defense mission. And then secondly, how energy supports the defense mission and how that's changing. Because both of those are very important for us to understand. And I'm just going to give a few thoughts on both of that. And it's a good time to have this kind of conversation because, of course, I don't think it's lost on anybody here that the department is right now in the middle of its most important strategy exercise with the Quadrennial Defense Review. So understanding new influences and our old influences and what they mean in the new situation, it's a good time to be having this kind of conversation, and you know, as well as we're going through a lot of institutional change. So I welcome that opportunity. Now, I wanted to start, though, by saying that as we look at the future, you have to do that by looking at the lessons learned over the last 12 years. And I wanted to do that by reading you some pieces of an article. And it's hard for me to read this, and I know it's harder for Bob and others who've had to live it. But it's an illustration of that you stand where you sit. And this is a painful article that was in Vanity Fair in December 2011, although when I went to print it, I found that the most popular article in Vanity Fair right now that's being forwarded is Kate Middleton's post-baby routines, muesli bars, homemade smoothies, and nanny-less time with George. So if you want to talk about that, maybe we can just talk about that.
That's our next event.
Right, okay. This is a tough article by Mark Bowden about a combat outpost in Afghanistan that was overrun. And it's a really an article about accountability, but because I do energy in military operations, that's not the part of it that got my attention. So that's the part of it I want to read to you. They're talking about this base where Task Force Rock was, and they are saying, he writes, a single partially paved road wound south toward Camp Blessing, the headquarters for Task Force Rock, 2nd Battalion, 503rd Infantry Regiment, 173rd Airborne Brigade, which is important because later on maybe we can talk about some of the things we've done subsequent to this with the 173rd. The battalion HQ was just 5 miles away in the lens of a drone, but on the ground it was a perilous journey of about an hour. Perilous because ambushes and IEDs were common. Skipping ahead, we're talking about a guy that had just arrived, Captain Matthew Meyer. He had only arrived the day before, and he'd sketched out a basic plan for the combat outpost. So he sketched it out, and he left the supervision of the construction to First Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom. After consultations with Meyer and the battalion commander, Brostrom had drawn up detailed maps of the new outpost on whatever scraps of paper he could find so that he could show his men sectors of fire for all of the vehicles, the placement of the Claymore mines, and the location of fighting positions, the latrine, and everything else. A small force of Afghan contractors with heavy equipment were to handle most of the construction, but they'd been delayed, awaiting the completion of a road-clearing mission. In the interim, the platoon itself had begun building the outpost's preliminary defenses, toiling in 100-degree heat with limited water and resources, hacking away at the baked, stubborn soil. They had to take the HESCOs down to half of their height because they had to figure out how to fill them, HESCOs being the barriers that you build around a perimeter of a combat outpost. All the fighting positions were makeshift. The command post was a sunken space about 2 feet deep. And I'm skipping around. Lacking enough men for both constructions is the key part. Lacking enough men for both construction and patrols, Brostrom had chosen to concentrate on construction. The platoon had conducted a perfunctory patrol to scout the immediate vicinity, but that was it. and the platoon had yet to establish a useful observation post. So you can get what happened. This is the opportunity cost of not thinking about how we resource operations with energy, because I can assure you that was part of the problem here. As these guys were on scraps of paper trying to figure out what their contingency base should look like, they probably had generators that were drastically oversized for the loads. They probably had one on every single load, which meant they were burning it out. They were burning through fuel. These roads were hard to access, and anybody that had to bring them that fuel was putting their lives at risk. Or if they were coming by helicopter, there was a very hot zone. It meant that anybody in the helicopter, these guys got attacked the next day with RPGs and other kinds of fire. You can hit a helicopter. Even the Taliban can do that. So you get a picture right away of if we don't manage our resources as a platform or as a warfighting input, these are the people that pay the price. And this is not something that we necessarily capture in our statistics. It's hard to get at what the cost of this kind of problem is. So I'm not going to dwell on the lessons learned more than I think you get the point, that we have to see energy. We have to see the resources as inputs to warfighting capability and take it seriously and not just assume that we'll have what we need when we need it, where we need it, in a reliable, affordable way. And that's the central lesson learned that we're carrying forward. And you think about what this means in Afghanistan, just one more thing on the lessons learned. We're the most sophisticated, capable fighting force in the world. And I have no doubt whatsoever that we can protect movements of fuel anywhere. But that there is an opportunity cost, and sometimes it looks like that. And so if there's something we can do to lower the risk and increase the capability at the pointy edge, at the tactical edge, then we should. It's our responsibility to do that. We're putting, it varies anywhere from 20 to 50 million gallons of fuel on the road every day in Afghanistan, and these are the conditions. These are not everywhere, but in a lot of places. And if we can take some of that risk out and make it more capable, that's what we have to do. Well, so if you take that forward going into the future, we're looking at a future threat environment where it's not just suicide bombers or IEDs that can target your combat forces and, of course, your supply lines, of course. I mean, since people have been waging war, your supply lines are in play. If you can get them, they're in play. And in distributed operations, they're in play. So it's not just going to be suicide bombers and homemade weapons, but it's also going to be precision weapons, precision-guided munitions from mines to RPGs to missiles, everything. So, but also computer viruses, electronic warfare. We're going to face adversaries who are able to target us, both state and non-state. It's going to be a threat. It's also going to be a threat to our access, which is, of course, what the department is calling anti-access area denial, the ability to control where we go and keep us out in addition to actual warfighting. So that's how it looked in Afghanistan. That's how it looks going forward. This is about being able to project and sustain force for the global mission.
That's Sharon Burke, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs on Pentagon Solutions today. More highlights from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in a minute on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Your data could help you get more for your budget, improve outcomes, or reveal hidden opportunities. Turn to Deloitte. We help federal agencies go beyond face value and blend their data with technologies like cloud, mobile, geo, and social to deliver more mission for less money. So you can imagine the possible and do things differently. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Hey, everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. This Sunday at 11, we're taking you back with us to Lambstock for part two of our, what would you call it, our field report from this three-day festival that was filled with chefs and mixologists and coffee roasters and oystermen and you name it. But it was really all about lamb, and we're going to tell you all about it this coming Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 AM.
Security. It's more than a headline in today's newspaper. It's your job to securely manage the thousands of printed pages your organization produces each year. That's why GovConnection is your premier provider for HP end-to-end print technology solutions. HP devices are future-proof for security and comply with regulatory mandates. Users can print and digitize documents without compromising safeguards. Learn more and take advantage of end-of-year volume discounts at govconnection.com/HP.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Agency of the Month is brought to you by CenturyLink from this month's agency, Department of the Navy.
Rear Admiral Sean Buck is director of the Navy's 21st Century Sailors Office. He describes the Navy's suicide prevention policy.
The way that we are handling it in the Navy is with another continuum, the continuum of stress. And on the left side of that continuum is all of the things that we're putting in place for prevention.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com.
It looks like the forecast is calling for a whole new cloud. Brought to you by CenturyLink. Get a visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions with CenturyLink, all built on a global, secure, carrier-grade network. And their custom solutions and support models are designed to enhance your efficiency every day of the week. Let their cloud infrastructure blanket you with security. Visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov to learn more.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Thursday's Federal Drive. The government oversees $1 trillion in student loans. Now the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says hundreds of billions of that should be forgiven, like, for instance, yours. The ombudsman, Rohit Chopra, explains. Plus, the GAO is revising the Green Book for internal controls. This isn't just for bean counters. Those stories much more tomorrow morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Now your DHS News Brief, brought to you by CenturyLink. Random passengers at airports will be selected for quicker security screening. The Transportation Security Administration says passengers won't have to provide extra personal information to qualify. Bloomberg reports the TSA will choose customers based on a background check before they get to the airport. For Federal News Radio, I'm Sean McCauley.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're hearing highlights of an event hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies looking at the Defense Department's operational energy for the upcoming decade as military branches restructure and budgets become even more critical. Maren Lead is moderator of this event. She's a CSIS staffer and the speakers at this event, Sharon Burke and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke. In this highlight, Secretary Burke talks more about the global energy picture that shapes DOD's mission.
The global energy picture is getting a lot more complicated in ways that are fascinating. So even as mature economies increase efficiency, switch fuels, and reduce their petroleum demand, the thirst for energy, and specifically for oil and natural gas, is growing all over the world. And a lot of that growth is going to be in non-OECD countries. In total energy demand, it's China, India, and the Middle East that are going to account for 60% of the increase in specifically for oil, demand for oil over the next 20 years. That's going to, according to the IEA, require some $37 trillion in new investment. So this is a big commitment, a big deal. And, you know, the good thing there is that no one consumes energy for its own sake. You consume energy for the services it provides. And that means that this is all good news. It means that we're going to see countries develop. We're going to see people coming out of poverty. It's all good news. But it also means that the global energy landscape is changing quite a bit. And I think, you know, the country that's getting the most attention for redrawing the lines in this is, of course, the United States. We're the ones that are bucking the trend of more demand and less supply. And I think, you know, all the new production coming online in the United States was really unimaginable for a lot of people a decade ago. And I'm sure there are people here who knew that it was going to happen. And you can take us all out to lunch. So I did not see it coming myself. But, you know, the understanding before was that our production peaked in 1970 and has been declining ever since, that our imports were increasing, and of course, you know, as recently as maybe 5 years ago, our imports hit 60%. That picture is just gone. We're, I think the latest numbers from the Energy Information Administration is we're at 36% imports. So domestic oil and gas production, the increase, us as a major producer for these hydrocarbons, is just a different picture altogether. I mean, in natural gas, the biggest problem at the moment is low prices, which, you know, go figure. Now, so does it matter? And is it good news? Is it bad news? It's, of course it's good news. People are justifiably excited about it, about the implications for the U.S. economy and the manufacturing sector, about jobs coming home, about industry coming home or growing, about our balance of payments. I mean, just the trade deficit for oil alone, I think about 5 years ago, was about $42 billion, give or take half a billion. You know, that's DOD speak. It's $17 billion today. I mean, that's a meaningful change for our economy, for our economic security. So this does mean something, and it is good. But there's an interesting question to ponder, which is, you know, so that's good, that's all well and good, but does it matter beyond that from a national security point of view? And the answer is no, it doesn't. And yes, it does. So, and we don't know as part of it. So why doesn't it matter? I think there's a real danger that all the enthusiasm for the new production will mask for the public and for a lot of policymakers that even as we move towards self-sufficiency here in North America, we're still going to be part of a global energy market. I mean, we're talking about a market of 90 million barrels a day consumed worldwide, and the trend is up, up, up. Not here, but everywhere else. So the world supply and demand trends, which are going to be driven by all of that, about that global supply and that global growing demand, is going to continue to shape our own prosperity here at home. And again, I think that gets a little bit masked in what's happening in energy markets here at home. And there's every reason to believe that we're going to still see volatility in the markets, and especially in the global oil market. So it does matter. So it doesn't matter on that, in that sense. We're still going to see some of the same kinds of things we've always seen. Maybe lower amplitude. Who knows? We'll see as that unfolds. But at the same time, I think it matters how these trends may affect geopolitics and regional stability. And I think, you know, we at the Department of Defense are still looking at how all these factors are going to come together and what it means. So, you know, it's a complicated world out there, and certainly in energy security terms, that's true. You know, you're hearing things like that the Saudis might become net importers of oil by 2030, and, of course, Iran repeatedly threatening to close the Strait of Hormuz, energy flashpoints in a number of places like the South China Sea, changes in the Arctic and what that means for global relationships. But, you know, just some new considerations taking place, too, that we need to understand better and take into account is the changing relationships between energy producers and energy consumers. So consider that the U.S. is no longer the largest energy consumer and is, depending on who you talk to, is no longer the largest oil consumer. China is, of course. They're the largest customer in the world and the largest consumer. And what does that mean for producer-consumer relations, and what does that mean for geopolitics? It's a good question. Russia is starting to look east, and there's a producer-consumer relationship there, along with a lot of defense sales, not necessarily to each other, but to others. And the confluence of that and what that means is a very interesting question. That's good enough on that, but also the way that these changing dynamics are changing stability. So that so-called social price of oil, which is a lot of we are one of the few countries in the world, maybe one of two, that has private ownership of the mineral rights. So everybody else, it goes to the state, right? And the state uses oil revenues and natural gas revenues to support all kinds of social programs. In a lot of countries, that means they need a certain price to be able to support all those commitments. What happens when the price dips below there? What if it stays below? And, you know, you'll see a lot of different calculations on what various countries need the price to be. We may find out what they actually need it to be. And think about the different ways that this refracts through security. So you've got a situation in Libya right now where Libya's ability to stabilize is very much dependent on their ability to have oil revenue. But they need to stabilize in order to get oil revenue. That's going to be a tough one. That's not the only place we're going to see that. We're going to see that in Egypt. Someday you'll see that in Syria. These are not big global producers, but the energy they produce is essential for their own stability. I think you should keep your eye on Venezuela on that one for sure. And that one has got significance for the global markets. These things are changing. Mexico, I think, is a real bright spot there. You see, this is a nation that has some changes in place as a producer. And, again, this reinforces that North American self-sufficiency is going to be an interesting dynamic in this. But also, you know, the issues of access to the global commons and who's most invested in that. If we're not buying directly from the Persian Gulf, say, but the Chinese certainly are, I think about 74% of the offtake from there right now is going to Asian countries. So that's an interesting question. How does that all play out?
That's Sharon Burke, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs. More highlights from her presentation and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke's presentation at the Center for Strategic and International Studies when we come back on Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
The Mobility Report is brought to you by CDWG.
The Postal Service is deploying more than 175,000 mobile devices to its letter carriers by the end of September. The Postal Service wants letter carriers to instantly upload their delivery information so its customers can track their packages in real time. The phones are Bluetooth ready, and the Postal Service says it's developing even more capabilities for letter carriers out in the field. The agency says it's the first step of a larger plan to expand its access to its customers. I'm Sean McCauley.
Voicemail, email, conferencing, IM. It's a mess. And if you're in federal IT, you're the cleanup crew. Visit cdwg.com/unified to see how a UC solution can help sort it out. Neat and tidy is our specialty. CDWG, people who get it.
Visit cdwg.com to learn how UC solutions from Microsoft can help you improve productivity by streamlining communications.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Fish oil and stress. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Nicholas Garlow with HHS HealthBeat. A challenging math problem can stress you out. Researchers at Michigan Technological University had participants in a study do those challenging problems, measuring if and how stress levels were affected by fish oil supplements. 67 adults were examined before and after 8 weeks of taking fish oil supplements or a placebo, olive oil. They measured heart rate and blood pressure, finding fish oil supplements help protect the heart in stressful situations. Dr. Jason Carter led the study.
We suggest individuals with high stress lives might consider taking fish oil supplements or regularly consume fish high in omega-3 fatty acids at least once or twice a week.
The study in the American Journal of Physiology was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Nicholas Garlow.
The third annual Defense and Security Mobile Symposium is November 22nd at the Capitol Hilton. Brought to you by FCA DC, this year's theme is Beyond PIM, the business case for mobile as the next platform for innovation, transformation, productivity, and the mission. It will explore the need, use cases, and leaps forward that are possible with mobile. With leaders from DISA, NSA, DOD, DHS, the IC, and the major services, plus a competition for companies to present their mobile technologies. To register, visit fcadc.org/mobile.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. Facebook and Yahoo want to set the record straight on how much they cooperate with the National Security Agency's requests for users' information. They've appealed to the secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for help. They want permission to release more information on national security orders. They say they want to correct false claims. Google and Microsoft have similar motions pending with the court. All four companies give the NSA access to customer data under the program known as PRISM. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're listening to Pentagon Solutions today on In Depth, hearing highlights at an event hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies looking at operational energy at the Defense Department. The speakers at this event, Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff. In this highlight, General Rourke explains what's energy efficient for the Defense Department doesn't always sell in Congress.
In a previous job where I met Assistant Secretary Burke a couple years ago, I had responsibility for the Marine Corps facilities and installations energy. And yes, the Marine Corps does have several pretty darn good installation initiatives for renewables, things like wind turbines, solar panels, a fleet of energy efficient vehicles, cogen plants, and even a landfill gas project. However, I quickly learned a couple years ago this wasn't what sold in Congress. Notably with the staff members we briefed before our testimonies with the congressional committees. What the Congress was interested in was the operational energy piece. This is what sold them in terms of funding and support, from what I could tell. Now, that was 2 years ago. Directly supporting the soldier, sailor, marine, airman on the ground in either Iraq or Afghanistan to reduce their reliance on energy, notably fossil fuels, and increase their survivability is what drew headlines. The Army and Marine Corps has and has continued to have some very excellent small unit and base camp examples in this regard that do well today, even in Afghanistan. In terms of operational effectiveness, and clearly this is just common sense to any of us in here, I don't think any commander would ever compromise effectiveness in accomplishing his or her mission and taking care of his men and women on the battlefield. There's no equation for success in a conflict, but years in military school has always noted the time-tested ingredients and fundamentals for success in a conflict likely include overwhelming maneuver, tempo, the ability to outthink, outdecide, and outact before your opponent can, to concentrate forces with decisive power at critical points in time, and then redeploy for a variety of other missions. These are components that today's operational energy initiatives must work with. As far as the future, the U.S. military is transitioning from over a decade of war to a world that appears to be trending possibly towards greater stability overall, but with things like the A2AD concepts and destructive technologies out there that can be acquired pretty easily by a wide range of actors. These technologies are not necessarily prohibitively expensive, and they may not cost our enemies a lot in terms of dedicated personnel, training, material, and facilities, and they could be devastating to anyone. As a result, the world is potentially more dangerous than ever before. A concept for dealing with this new security environment is evolving to defend against a very wide range of security challenges, from those in both space and cyberspace, from anti-access and aerial denial capabilities that you learned about. And this concept is called global integrated operations. So where I'm going with this thing is that part of Joint Forces 2020 is to be able to conduct something called global integrated operations. And it means that basically we can aggregate forces, we can deploy, we can employ, and we can redeploy, and then we can do it all over again. Now, the force size could be small. It could be small to large. As a logistician, when you're talking about forming, deploying, employing, redeploying, and doing that possibly in smaller size units on a wide variety of geography, that concerns me. And that should concern everybody that works with operational energy. The hardest units I've ever had to support in the past are the little isolated ones that aren't self-sufficient, that are out on their own, on the wings, on the flanks. That is very tough to do. So we have to be thinking about that. And I know the commanders will think about that in their plans. To me, the coming fiscal austerity, the future points to a smaller, more capable force. I've recently read the phrase in some of the joint doctrine, we need to get smaller to get stronger. And I think it's a bullseye. We just won't be able to afford all the necessary capabilities, plus those we're bringing in between now and 2020 for today's larger force construct. So I think it's going to be not only smaller and stronger, but much more capable. I think all the services, all the combatant commands, want more of the operational efficiency on the battlefield. Less energy requirement is less risk to the mission, which is measured in lives saved. I think the younger servicemen and women get operational energy intuitively. It's the older ones, the folks that are my age, perhaps the older contractors, that may have a harder challenge. They say that if you're a large organization, you're old, and you're tradition-based, it's harder to change. That defines the Marine Corps, and that's some... I led something called logistics modernization years ago, and I learned a lot about that. There's some very good stories about a Marine Infantry Battalion, the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, who literally embraced operational and energy initiatives in Afghanistan. 3-5 had the highest combat casualty rate of any unit at that time and to date in the Marine Corps, and viewed anything that unleashed their tether to fuel and energy and the large logistics tail that resupplied them as something that increased their survivability. Their use of solar power and renewables operating from small tactical patrol bases helped provide the benefits in combat, and that's documented. From my end in the J4C, just a couple of weeks here, the approach to December 14 and redeployment from Afghanistan and the coming fiscal austerity does have me thinking about the future of logistics. My concern is a very possible and likely target for budget cuts is logistics, especially if manpower and healthcare costs are not touched. Another concern is that much of the joint logistics capability for ground combat operations is in the Army Reserve and the Army National Guard, up to 85% by most accounts. That means it's challenging to activate and deploy and employ reserve water production, fuel distribution, and inland distribution trucking capability within a short time frame, and I'm talking about 60 days, for example. That makes aggregating, deploying, employing, and redeploying challenging. Last I checked, we relied on contractors to do the line haul from door to door in support of Afghanistan. And how much capability do we have in the military, and is it enough? And how do we fill the gaps in that capability? How do we reduce the tether to fossil fuels?
That is Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff, speaking at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can learn more about this event later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and more highlights on the way on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Today's Human Capital Management Report brought to you by the Graduate School.
More than 6,000 civilian employees at the Defense Department could face layoffs in 2014 if sequestration continues. That's according to a draft Pentagon planning document obtained by Bloomberg News. Under the plan, the Army and Navy would each be looking at over 2,000 layoffs. Another 1,500 reductions in force would come from individual agencies within DOD. The Pentagon is facing approximately $52 billion in cuts if sequestration remains in effect in 2014.
Achieving workforce development goals in today's environment can be challenging, but Graduate School USA offers a creative approach to training solutions and more than 90 years of training excellence. Ranked as the most affordable and overall best choice for federal training, the school offers hundreds of top quality courses, including customized programs designed for your budget and your needs.
Get more out of your training budget. Visit graduateschool.edu. That's graduateschool.edu.
Read something interesting on federalnewsradio.com and want to share it with your colleagues and friends? Our enhanced articles make it easier than ever to recommend a story to your Facebook friends, tweet it out to your followers, email it to your colleagues, and now share the story directly with your connections on LinkedIn and Google+. One click is all it takes to share the latest news affecting federal employees and government contractors. federalnewsradio.com.
The Military Officers Association of America and the National Defense Industrial Association will host the annual Warrior Family Symposium, a forum for discussing mental health and the challenges facing our warriors and family members, on September 12th from 7:30 to 2:30 at the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center. Space is limited. Visit warriorfamilysymposium.com to register. All active and retired military or guard and their spouses can attend for free. That's warriorfamilysymposium.com for more information.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're hearing highlights of an event on operational energy at the Defense Department hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff, the speakers at this event. The moderator is CSIS's Marin Lead. And in this highlight in your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes after, Ms. Lead has an inside baseball question for Secretary Burke and General Rourke.
You are part of acquisition technology and logistics. The whole front part of your conversation was essentially about broader defense policy issues that are typically not directly the purview of AT&L. And General Rourke, I think, rightly pointed out that Congress tends to be supportive of, most supportive of these operational energy, directly tactically applicable kinds of initiatives. So, if the opportunity for those kinds of initiatives is going down, or we hope it will go down, how do you position yourself, both of you, to influence that broader conversation about the value of some of the installation things that General Rourke has managed before and I think continues to have some hand in, but also the policy questions? How does your office handle that institutional shift and keep momentum?
Cookies, cake, bribes, no. Although I would say proselytizing has been a lot of our mission and making sure that we can document what the challenge here is and then show it to senior commanders. But one of the big challenges for the office from the beginning, certainly we focused on fielding for Afghanistan and rapid fielding, and Bob's been a great partner in that and making improvements in how we are actually operating. But at the same time, we were very much aimed at the future force development from the very beginning and getting into how the department grows the force. And so being in acquisition technology and logistics was a very helpful place to be for that, because it is where, for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, some of those longer-term issues are being chewed up and decided and overseen. So being part of those communities means that, you know, we get to play a part in the Joint Staff's requirements definition, and we get to play a part formally on the Defense Acquisition Board. We've been playing in Title 10 service military department war games and bringing energy in as a consideration to those games. We're playing a part in how acquisition technology and logistics advises the Quadrennial Defense Review and the Defense Strategic Guidance and the classified guidance that comes off of that. So in those longer-term issues, it's been extremely helpful, and also for innovation. And the acting head of the Research and Engineering Department right now is a very good partner for us, and we work with him very closely about the best ways to promote innovation in this area. And I think, so being an AT&L has been very helpful. As Bob mentioned, also I have put staff in a couple of the combatant commands and spent a lot of time working with them, because, of course, their demand signal for capability, their ability to incorporate energy as either a vulnerability or an advantage into their plans and into their exercises is a very important element. So pretty much by a full institutional engagement in all the key places where these kinds of decisions are being made, we've either had a formal authority or interaction or have certainly engaged extensively. So that, you know, we've been targeting the future force development from the very beginning.
I'm sorry, did you want to add to that?
Sure. I think there is a tie-in with the installation side. I think a lot of the good initiatives that we take into the operational world forward come from some sort of science and technology that breaks into the installation piece. The renewables just bring something to the mind. And I also think that something that we can do on the joint staff to influence some of the key performance parameters is just start rethinking some of the newer initiatives that are coming in, newer vehicles like the Joint Light Tactical Vehicle or the Ground Combat Vehicle or the replacement to the Bradley and things like that. I think instead of just looking at it as one weapon system or one communication system or one piece of medical equipment at a time, we really have to look at the entire, in the logistics world, I'd call it the supply chain, because everybody's always out there trying to maximize the performance in their part of the supply chain, let's say at the wholesaler level, at the expense, and they don't realize it, at the expense of someone else. And so I have this happen all the time when I was at CENTCOM, and somebody has a better way to get food in the country, and yet the people that have to fly it say, wait a minute, that's going to cost us three times the amount, da-da-da-da-da-da. So I think you have to look at the entire effect on fuel, on fossil fuels, on energy, the entire range of supply. Quite frankly, there's some things out there that that may appear that they use more fuel. Let's say K-MAX, an unmanned aerial vehicle. It's an unmanned aerial helicopter, a logging helicopter used in RC Southwest. And you may look at that, and that's shuttling supplies, unmanned, by the way, incredible distances in Helmand Province. You may look, oh, that's just, you know, it's using a lot of fuel. Well, maybe it's not if you take it all the way back in the supply chain. And then, of course, it's keeping convoys off the road. And so I used to say in maintenance that we have more people tracking maintenance than actually doing maintenance. Now, I didn't really mean that. But in the field of energy, I think we just need to add that training piece to our folks that work with fuels. We have a lot of people working with fuels, with fossil fuels, tracking it, moving it, accounting for it every day. And I think all we have to do is infuse with them training on how to think about it differently, because they'll force us to think about it differently. And then I can go in and I say, hey, this concept of operations isn't necessarily a bad one. Look at what the whole supply chain is going to look like. It's going to be better.
That's Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff. More highlights for the Center for Strategic and International Studies coming up in just a minute on Pentagon Solutions on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
At VAE Systems, protecting troops is always a top priority. That's why we create combat vehicles that not only help them win the fight, but bring them back home. Our vehicles are designed from the ground up with the latest integrated solutions, all with troops in mind. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day, so we'll be there on the next front. That's VAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at vaesystems.com/nextfront.
Please join Max Kakis, host of AFCEA Answers, Friday, September 13th at 2.05 p.m., where he'll be joined by a panel of government and industry professionals to discuss big data in government. The panel will include Dan Doney, Chief Innovation Officer at DIA. Don't miss AFCEA Answers with Max Kakis, Friday, September 13th at 2.05 p.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and online at federalnewsradio.com, sponsored by AFCEA International and brought to you by HP and Intel.
Where do some of the country's best of the best college graduates go? Well, if you're in technology, you head to Silicon Valley, and finance, it's Wall Street. And if medicine is your passion, you come here to Kaiser Permanente. What brings top medical school graduates from Harvard, Yale, and Johns Hopkins here? Simply put, Kaiser Permanente lets doctors be doctors, not paper pushers or insurance noodlers. Our unique system of healthcare was set up from the start to clear the distractions and let doctors do exactly what they were called to do, care for patients, using every resource
source every technological advancement, every piece of evidence they can get their hands on. They come here because Kaiser Permanente makes great doctors even better doctors. Where do you go to get some of medicine's very best? Join us at kp.org to find your doctor, because the best of the best members deserve the best of the best choice. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated. 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
DRS is up and running.
Monitoring a border is complex. At DRS, we've deployed technology on the Jordanian border.
DRS is proven.
With desert installations in Egypt, we thrive in the most forbidding terrain.
DRS is ready.
And in Arizona, DRS is ready with the most advanced technology. We're prepared to support the U.S. Customs and Border Protection IFT program. DRS Technologies, up, running, and ready to protect the U.S. border.
Learn more at DRS.com.
Calling all government, military, and defense industry executives, the Association of the United States Army invites you to its 59th annual meeting and expo.
October 21st through the 23rd at the D.C. Convention Center, AUSA's annual meeting is one of the largest land warfare forums in the world.
Companies will gather to display the latest defense technology, and forums will be held for soldiers, family, government defense civilians, and industry executives.
Admission is free, limited to qualified persons. For details, visit AUSAannualmeeting.org.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. One more highlight to bring you of the Center for Strategic and International Studies event on operational energy at the Defense Department. The speakers at the event, Sharon Burke, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Operational Energy Plans and Programs, and Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J-4 Joint Staff. Marin Lead of CSIS is the moderator of this event.
Obviously, that's an important question. I think the COCOMs are, thanks to Ms. Burke and her visits and providing us with feet on the ground forward and lots of food. Marine will do anything for a good donut, so let me... But I think having people on board to force us to think about it is absolutely imperative. We've already got, for example, on a typical COCOM staff, you've got environmental engineers that tell you about how important it is to get rid of burn pits and things like that. The same thing with operational energy. You have to push those initiatives forward. She's also pushed experts out into Afghanistan. So we have some excellent successes out there beyond just the renewable energy for recharging communication batteries and lights and running command posts. If I recall right, in Bagram, I think there's about 3,150 set camps that are built all about using more operational efficient tents, camps, messing, showers, things like that. And it works, and it's the right thing to do, because over the years, our living standards for some reason in Iraq and Afghanistan, once we got onto the forward operating bases and the maneuver phases were over, they just kind of crept. It was kind of like a mission creep, but the standards went up, and we lived really well. The case in point is that possibly our expeditionary housing sets weren't as energy efficient that they could be. And I'm talking about our force provider and our Harvest Bear type sets that two of the services have. So I think that's a great target. And what happened? We just took some good ideas from the commercial world, and we implemented them, the Army implemented them, and did a fine job. Same thing with some of their generators. They have a new generator that you can take out, a mobile generator that uses about 25% of the power, or 25% savings on the power. And when you see the base camps, you know there's a lot of air conditioners and generators out there, and it's a significant saving. So I think that the other technology that comes to mind is microgrids, and the fact that and I have to be careful with some of these things. They work really well. When I was a base commander in Iraq of 8,000 people, the most scary operation was not defending the base or doing those ancillary things associated with security. It was watching someone who I couldn't even talk to, contractors from a different part of the world, didn't speak English, completely rewire an 8,000-person base camp and set up new generators. That was scary. That got my hair on fire. Not literally, but actually. But I think that's all related there. We're growing in leaps and bounds in what we can do. We have to be a little cautious that some of these technologies that come in, like the microgrids and things like that, will need some specially trained people, and that'll be a cost somewhere in our training pipeline.
That's Lieutenant General Robert Rourke, Director of Logistics for the J4 Joint Staff, speaking at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And you're hearing it on Pentagon Solutions on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Hour number two of In Depth with Francis Rose is right around the corner. And later this afternoon, you can learn more about this CSIS event at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.